Thank you so much, Dr. Dagher. That was a fascinating presentation. I have one question to start it off. From your perspective and your investors' perspective, what does success look like? And what's a commercially viable offshore wind farm look like at some point in the future?
Success comes in certainly very, very good questions. Thanks for asking, John. Our ultimate goal is to make sure, first and foremost, that technologies like this coexist with other uses of the environment around us, whether it's the birds, the bats, the fish, and so forth, coexist with the fishing industry. That's very important to us, trying to find ways that we can all coexist, where the fishing industry can continue to thrive, and these kinds of industries can also grow off the coast of Maine. That's really the ultimate goal. From this experiment, the very first experiment, our goal is to figure out how to build these things, figure out that it's going to actually do what our numerical models said it was going to do, better understand the fishermen and fishing around it, and work with the fishing industry to develop methods and means and methods to fish around this. So that's really what success is. It's all these pieces. And I'd like to take it a step at a time, John. And the first step really is building one hull, learning from it, all of us together, and using that as a springboard to go to the research array and beyond. And so our eyes are is on that one hull here right now, and making sure it's a successful project, both from an environmental, ecological perspective, learn as much as we can from it, and use that to if you wish, plan the next steps. Does that answer your question, John?
It sure does. Thank you so much. We have another question in the chat. I'll just go ahead and read it. This is from John Ramos. Hello, thank you for this. This is very interesting. I have a couple questions regarding the export cable lines that carry the electricity back. If dependency increases on wind and the line gets damaged, what's the worst case scenario regarding this? Would full-time replacement be needed? If underground, could the line move enough to become exposed, damaged over time? And finally, are you working with NOAA to get these lines charted?
Oh, very, very good question. Thank you for asking that question. There's good news and there's bad news. The good news is we've operated lines like this under sea cables in the Gulf of Maine for a long time. So it's not new. We have a number of these connecting the mainland to islands off the coast of Maine, and they've operated successfully. And so we have some experience using developing these lines. Now, in terms of how to, could they be snagged? The answer is yes, they could be snagged if they're not properly installed, not properly placed, not properly protected. They could be snagged, and they have been damaged in offshore wind farms in Europe. There's been instances where these have been damaged. So it's very important to do proper design and planning for the route of those lines and the route to shore and proper protection of those lines. Typically, people like to bury a line about 6 feet in the mud if you're able to bury it. If you bury it 6 feet in the mud, you're less likely to have scour over time and have it getting exposed in the long run. But of course, the challenge is that you may not find a route from a farm to the mainland that's completely buried. You may, because of the geology of the Gulf of Maine, you may not find that line. And in which case you would have to go over some solid ground, in which case you'd have to protect it in some other ways. And as I said earlier, one way to protect them is these concrete, if we use blankets that are used. They're, if you went to the, they look like very large tiles that you'd use to tile the walls in your kitchen, in your bathroom or the kitchen. If you have these tiles that are hooked together, where you buy from Home Depot or Lowe's, and you put them on the wall, there might be 30 or 40 tiles in a group. And that's what these blankets look like. They're basically made out of 1 foot by 1 foot thick, wide concrete blocks that are hooked together with synthetic ropes, and they form a big blanket, and you place it over the lines to prevent it from being snagged. But you've asked a very important question in terms of charting these. It's too early to chart them right now for the Gulf of Maine. We don't even know where these, the full-scale farms would go. For that particular single unit, we are working and have looked at different routes to shore for that particular unit. It's a single turbine. It's going to be a 12 megawatt maximum cable. It's going to, the diameter of that cable is about that yay big. Okay. It's about 66 megawatt. I don't know if you could see my fingers. That's about how big that cable is going to be. We'd like to bury it as much as we can, wherever we can. And we're looking at that right now, looking at different ways to bring it back to shore to bury that cable. Of course, we'll be working with the Coast Guard, with NOAA and others on identifying where that is and making sure it's properly charted. So I hope I've answered your question.
You have. I see Lauren Brooks has a question. Lauren, you need to unmute.
Yeah. Can you hear me okay?
Yes, Lauren.
Okay. I'm a commercial fisherman and I'm representing them on the board here. We got some questions on the electric field that the cable is going to be generating going to shore. Does that affect marine life on the bottom?
Very good question, Lauren, and I'm glad you asked that. That's something that we are very concerned about and looking at. There's been a number of studies done about such cables. They've been done by BOEM, actually. BOEM has published a big study, and their results show that if they're properly installed and properly shielded, those cables should not affect the marine environment. But again, it's properly installed, properly shielded cables. These cables, Lauren, already exist in the Gulf of Maine. We're not trying to do anything new. They exist between the mainland and the islands. And we've already installed them for decades in the Gulf of Maine. So the important piece is a proper installation and proper shielding for the cables. And if you do that, we should be in good shape. That's what the data shows. That's the quick answer, Lauren. But there is a big report about the studies that have been done by BOEM, and you actually can download that study online from the BOEM website. That's the Bureau of Ocean Energy Management. Yep.
Okay, I got a couple actually. Hazard navigation, when you get 12 of them out there, I think that's gonna be a big issue for us fishermen. And how many would you have, how much area would you take for 12 of these arrays?
Yes, very, very good question, Lauren. And let me go back and say that we're not working, the university is not working right now on a 12 unit array. We're not doing that. We're focused on this particular project. But the state is, and the state is trying to identify how big that needs to be and evaluate that. But roughly, the hulls need to be about a mile apart. Okay, just to put that in perspective. So if you look at arranging them, so you got to have a mile between the hulls. If you end up putting 12 of them, one way you can do them, you can make them in groups of four. You can put them in groups of four. So a group of four, you might have a 1 mile by 1 mile square, if you wish, Lauren, and you could have one turbine in each corner. Does that make sense? Then you have you can have three of these groups, for example, that are 1 mile by 1 mile. So the idea here is, could you have three groups of four, if you wish, and each group of four is a 1 mile by 1 mile group with a turbine on each corner. That's one possibility. Again, this hasn't been decided yet, but that's one way you can potentially do that. One thing we're very interested in Lauren, is how do you space these groups of four to still allow fishing and to still allow vessels through them. So if you have groups of four, and if you, as I said, the rectangle, the square is 1 mile by 1 mile by 1 mile square. And how far do you put these apart? Do you put them a mile and a half apart so you can actually easily sail between the groups of four? These are some of the questions that we really need to look at, and only by working very closely with your industry, Lauren, we can figure out a way that that works for the fishing industry as well as for offshore wind. So the answer is a mile apart. Okay, that's roughly what you need. That's the quick answer.
I'm assuming that all the cables will be coming together and then running in as one cable.
Yes, indeed, Lauren. So the idea is in fixed bottom offshore wind farms, what they've done in Europe is they have a farm with 100 of these turbines, and they say you have 10 groups of 10 to make up 100. And they would take each group of 10 and tie them all together in one cable, if you wish. And then all the groups of 10 come together to one point and you have one export cable to shore. So does that answer your question, Lauren?
Yes. Yeah. Would national security be a problem with these arrays coming in?
What was the question, national security?
Yeah, these being out there. I mean,
One thing there's been some questions, Lauren, about the effect on radar. Say if there are some defense facilities on the coast that are using radars or sending radars, these could interfere with radar observations. But there are ways around that as well. So. But in terms of the security of the farm itself, there's been, over 2,000 of these turbines installed in Europe already. They've installed them since 1991. There's dozens of farms already operating, and they haven't had national security issues with those. So of course, you have to maintain security with these farms, but there hasn't been an issue since 1991 in security of these farms. But again, interference with radars from shore is a possibility, but there are workarounds around that. So, does that answer your question?
Yeah. Yes, and I get just one more. I hope, looking at your study with the 50-year storm with 50-foot seas, but I mean, I've seen 50-foot seas, but usually there's a lot of wind with them and with rolling white caps. And I've seen them go as high as your array there. I just don't know if, you know, you're going to be able to hold up in the environment out there in the Atlantic.
Yeah, that's certainly on the engineering side. I'm pretty confident. I'm very confident, Lauren, that we will hold up in there. We've done our studies and said we've been doing this for 12 years right now. Our designs have been reviewed by the American Bureau of Shipping independently, we feel pretty good about where we're at with the designs and the reviews that have taken place. I want to show you here what you're talking about. Here's an example. Can you see that slide,
Lauren? Yeah, I can see it.
You could see how one of the flotation columns completely submerged in this case. That was a 500-year storm relative to the size of that hull, and it moved off vertical less than 7 degrees. So we have evidence that it works, we have data and engineering and independent analysis. So we feel extremely good about this. I think my biggest concern here, Lauren, personally, my biggest concern is making sure that we can work with your industry and make sure that we can develop ways and means and methods to allow you to be able to fish in these farms and minimize impact on your industry. And it's gonna take us rolling up our sleeves all together and figuring out how to do that and do it safely. And we're fully committed to do so.
Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you. Appreciate your question.
Thank you. I see Dave Gelinas has a question.
Yes, Captain Gelinas, good to see you again.
You gotta hit mute.
There we go. Thanks. Great to see you, Doctor. A very excellent presentation. It's always interesting to hear about the project. So referring to slide number 25, I believe I saw what potentially looks like the unit being fabricated in Searsport. Are those our two docks, the existing bulk dock on the far part and then the existing oil dock? Where the actual unit is located?
Yes, Captain Gelinas, this is some thoughts and ideas we've worked on with you, actually, about 5 years, 5-6 years ago.
Right, I remember seeing some of those drawings earlier, yeah.
Yeah, these are the if you wish, and we've worked also with Sprague and the main DOT on it, one potential concept 5 or 6 years ago.
Yeah.
At this time, we really need to roll up our sleeves again, because the turbine has grown in size from 6 megawatt to something between 10 and 12, we need to look at it a bit differently, and so we need to go back and roll up our sleeves and get together again with you and with the main DOT and the Sprague folks and and the developers and figure this out. We had our first meeting last week, just kind of introductory meetings with the main DOT and the Sprague folks. And there's going to be a lot of work over the next months here to figure out the best way to do a bigger unit. So, and we'd appreciate your input. So.
Yeah, no, that's exciting, and it should be about. Are you projecting about 12 months to actually stack it all up and be on site before it's deployed?
That's what we're hoping here is trying to find a way to fabricate the whole thing in one season.
Yeah.
Okay. We're not there yet. We're trying to figure all that out. And there's going to be a lot of logistics because it is a bigger unit.
Yeah.
We're going to have to be casting a lot of concrete. And the question is, can we do it all in one season? And we're trying to figure that out. So again, stay tuned, and there's going to be a lot of hard work to answer those questions over the next few months. So
excellent. Thanks very much.
Thank you.
So we have three pending questions in the chat. First is from Lieutenant Doyle. The second is from Ivy, and the third is from Dennis Damon. Why don't we take them in that order? Lieutenant, are you able to?
Yes. Can you hear and see me?
Yes. Yes, indeed, Lieutenant.
How does it work if there's any snags, like fishing lines or any obstructions that we can't see? Do you guys frequently go to sites maybe once a month and send divers? Or like, how do you know if there's any issues below the water line?
Yes, very important questions. The question really is what is the frequency, what frequency we need to have for inspection below the water? And what regimes we need to use as we move forward. Having only a single hull in there gives us an opportunity to better understand how often we should be going out there. And that's a function also of how close are we gonna expect fishing to take place to this particular hull. And that would of course increase the chance of getting a line snagged and so on and so forth. So all of those are very important safety, if you wish, questions, both fishing safety as well as other forms of safety. So we need to sit down, roll up our sleeves, and figure out what are the safe standoff distances for fishing, for the fishermen around that line, for different types of fishing, and maybe certain types of fishing where you actually can get closer to the hull, other types of fishing you don't want to get closer to the hull. All of those are very important questions, but again, we can only figure those out by sitting down with the fishing industry, yourselves, and trying to answer those questions. So it's a great opportunity for all of us, if you wish, to figure out what we should do, what we think we should do, and then spend the next few years once we deploy the hull to figure out if we had a good plan or not. And so it's a good opportunity for all of us to try to figure all that out. We're also looking at, just to give you a sense, we're looking at different ways to moor the system as well. We just got a grant from the Department of Energy to look at synthetic mooring lines that might actually allow us to bring the anchor closer to the hull and have a smaller, if you wish, footprint of the system on the seabed. And we're going to be researching that. And if we go to an array in the future, we may try that in the array. We may even try that in Monhegan. So a lot to be learned. I think the best way to answer your question really is we need to all get together, all the right parties, and put a plan together in terms of standoff distances for fishing, working with the fishing industry, yourselves, the DOT, and others, and agree on a plan and monitor that plan over the next few years after we deploy the hull to make sure the plan really works and it provides the safety that we all need for all involved. So,
okay.
Does that answer your question, Sean?
Yes, the other one was simple. I remember we had a wind farm conference maybe a month or so ago, and you mentioned the 2023 date. Was that the date you wanted this to be fabricated and placed at the site?
So the current plan is to start fabricating the hull in 2022.
Okay.
With the idea that it would be installed in 2023. And I say that with some humility, because this is a very complex project and we can hit some snags that we were not aware of, whether it's environmental, ecological, port facility snags. So let's call it a target, if you wish, to start building in 2022 with a target to deploy in 2023. Let's all look at a plan and make sure we can execute it. Again, we need full involvement with the DOT, the Coast Guard, the state, DEP, and many others DMR to really make sure that the plan is doable, it's workable, and it's safe. So,
okay,
thank you.
That's
your question.
Yeah. Yes.
Thank you. Ivy, would you like me to read the question, or are you able to?
Thank you, John. So I'm Ivy Frenoka, Casco Bay Keeper with Friends of Casco Bay. It's nice to see you again, Dr. Dagher, and thank you for an excellent presentation. I also listened to one of the presentations for fishermen on the array that the state is working on. And I have some questions regarding that in terms of the timing and the research that will be done as we're scaling up wind energy from, you know, the small turbine to now a full-size turbine to an array. And those questions are, is the array different because it's going to go through a federal process as opposed to being in state waters? And then second, how will the research be scaled up to look at the cumulative impact on marine life and migrating birds and bats and butterflies? And third, in that same research question, my understanding from listening to one of those sessions is that there aren't studies right now of fishing around these floating turbines. And so how will those studies be done as you're scaling up the research? I guess what I'm really trying to understand is this incremental. Is the array designed to then take what you learned from this project, put more turbines with the same design out there, and continue progressive research so that we can really understand the impacts and make good decisions?
Extremely, very good question, Ivy. Thanks for asking that. I'd like to start by saying that I don't speak for the state of Maine. And so I really don't want to put any words in their mouth whatsoever. All I'd like to say is that we have been and our teams of researchers are available to the state of Maine to ensure continuity. We are working very closely with them, answering questions on their teams, but certainly I do not want to speak for the state because I'm not the state. The plan that they're pulling together is very carefully thought out, is actually being developed right now. That's why they're having these conversations, if you wish, to get input on what the plan should do and how the research should scale up. So I think your input is going to be very important. I think please provide additional input. The research plan is not set in stone yet. That's why they're having these conversations, if you wish, with different constituencies. What we did is I've showed you on the screen here. Here's all the kind of studies that we did before we put our single unit in there. You can see that, and we've done a lot of fish studies, bird studies, mammal studies. Actually, we've tagged some of the mammals there. The fish, we put sensors on the fish to see where they breed and where they go and so on and so forth. That's the kind of painstaking work we've done to make sure that we truly understand, at least in that Monhegan site, what lives under the water, what lives above the water, and how the turbine, when it comes in, is going to change that environment. So we've done, if you wish, a lot of homework to make sure we do the project right and understand the impacts. I think that same, if you wish, scientific approach the state wants to take in developing a research plan for the larger site and better understand the impact, the cumulative impact, if you wish, of a bigger, more than one unit working together. When you have more than one unit, of course, you have a different impact, right? A different impact on fishing, a different impact on the fish, on the birds, on the mammals. So the scientific, if you wish, studies that need to happen to properly deploy a large farm need to include the questions you're asking. And I'm confident, if you wish, that the state is approaching it in the right manner. They're talking to us, they're asking questions, they're trying to coordinate the work we're doing here with the array going in the future. So it is truly crawl before you walk, walk before you run type of approach that's being taken. So I can say that from my perspective, looking at what they're doing, I can assure you that I believe that's exactly what they're doing. That though I do not speak for them, so.
Thank
Does
you.
That answer your question?
Yes, but is there also going in federal waters and going through a BOEM process? So they'll be taking what
yes,
you
indeed.
Learn and then...
Yes, indeed. Yes, yes, yeah, yes. So to put a larger farm like that, really there's no place in state waters you can actually put 12 units. So you have to go to federal waters. And the state's goal have been to place these far enough from shore so they don't impact visual impact. So if you go over 20 miles offshore, plus, is the example, 20 to 40 miles offshore or more, you're not going to be able to see them. And by allowing you to go 20 or to 40 miles offshore, hopefully you have the ability then to select areas and minimize impact on the environment around them, whether it's the fishing community or the birds, bats, and benthic community as well. So by going that far out, you have a lot of places to choose from, and hopefully choose a place that minimizes impact. Of course, we're not going to take impact to zero. It's not possible. But the key is to select the site that will minimize impact and provide the most information to inform future developments. But yes, it'll be in BOEM territory. So it's yeah. Does that answer your question, Ivy?
Thank you. We have two live questions, one from Dennis and then Sarah Flank. One quick written question. Do you know if these systems use any oil or lubricants for moving parts? If so, in what quantity?
Yeah, so what's in the water itself, the hull itself has no oils or no lubricants in it. So the hull itself, if you wish, is... So what's in the water has no oil and no lubricants. The turbine itself, of course, has... components that have to be oiled and that have to be changed. And these are closed loop systems. The entire nacelle itself even is negatively, positively pressured to prevent even air leaks, if you wish, and salt air coming into the units and so forth. And these units, the new generation turbines are gearless turbines, basically, which minimizes a lot of the mechanical components and the oiling you have to use in these systems. So these gear-free turbines, if you use gearless turbines, are the ones that we hope to use and will be using in the future. There's maintenance where these, of course, the oils are changed in that unit on a regular maintenance schedule. As well, but they're very safe systems. There has not been, as far as I know, issues in Europe in the large farms that they've had out there with oil spills, if you wish, resulting from these turbines. I'm not aware of any significant issues resulting from oil spills in offshore turbines. So does that answer the question? Yeah.
I believe it does. Moving on to Dennis Damon.
Thank you, Professor Dagger, for a great presentation. I was struck by the size and the scope and the cost of this whole arrangement. I have a couple of questions with regards to the energy impact and the capture of energy and turning it into the electricity, which is the purpose of all this. I'm a big believer in getting the biggest bang for the buck. So you're utilizing the wind. Is there any thought given to also capturing some of the sun that's also out on the ocean and some of the wave or tidal energy that could be transmitted and do it all into one unit? Has any thought been given to that? And then I have a follow-up question.
Very, very good question, Dennis. Appreciate you asking it. Actually, we looked at these for quite some time initially. To say, okay, can we put wave energy devices on the hull? The hull's sitting out there anyway. Why don't you just put some wave energy devices on it and then capture the energy of the waves? That seems like a no-brainer, right, when you think about it to start with. So then you're capturing wind, you're capturing waves. What it turns out to be, Dennis, is that at least our numbers show today that it doesn't really make a lot of sense. And the reason for that is, there's so much more wind energy in the areas we're going versus the wave energy at that particular site that to give you a sense, if you're looking at an 11 megawatt turbine, let's say, for example, up there, the maximum you'll be able to generate from a wave energy device at that site might be half a megawatt. Okay, so I'm throwing some numbers around, just give you a sense. So if you can generate half a megawatt in waves, then all the additional equipment you have to maintain and add to the hull and new electrical lines and new maintenance schedules and so on and so forth, just to get another extra half a megawatt. Well, instead of doing that, go from an 11 megawatt turbine to a 12 megawatt turbine, okay? And it just, it doesn't make sense. It's getting too complicated for the extra, if you wish, benefit you would get out of it, which is very minimal. So complicating the system out there, you want to keep the system as simple as possible out there, as low cost as possible. So you want more energy, just put a bigger turbine on there, okay? And it's a lot simpler, a lot better. However, I'd like to point out that one real opportunity, I think there's an opportunity, is to co-locate aquaculture on these turbines. As you know, for example, we do a lot of mussel farming, and mussel farming needs rafts. And you pay a lot of money for the rafts and maintaining them and so on and so forth. Could you do mussel farming on one of these? Because you already have the raft. Okay, the hull is a raft, if you wish. And so there's opportunities to co-locate aquaculture that is, I think, is worthwhile investigating and evaluating as we move forward in this. That could be very interesting. Of course, I'm not going to tell you today that aquaculture and putting mussel rafts on these is a way to go. What I'm saying, it's worthwhile exploring at the stage of the game. In the same spirit of your question, what else can we do out there as long as we have this asset? So it seems to me, at least today, that they're doing that. Now, in terms of putting solar panels on top of water, people have actually looked at that and are trying to do that right now, particularly in lakes that are evaporating quickly, to try to protect the lakes from being evaporating as well. So not only are you generating electricity, but you're protecting from evaporation. In the ocean, it doesn't make sense to us right now. It takes to maintain these pieces again. It takes, you got a 100-year storm out there. You've got these floating panels that are hooked together, if you wish. In lakes, it makes sense. I think people are looking at that for solar panels on top of lakes that protect the lake from evaporation, but at the same time produces energy. I see that as a potential opportunity. So that's a bit of where we are. Hopefully I've addressed your question at a high level here, Dennis. So.
Thank you. You have. And this last one, I go back to the one of your beginning comments with regards to 3%. I think you were talking about 3% of the sea area of the Gulf of Maine, which would provide us with enough opportunity to capture energy and then turn it into electricity. If we were to utilize and 3% to me doesn't seem like an awful lot, except that later in your presentation, you talked about a 1 mile radius, and I think 1 mile would have a big impact on commercial fisheries. But the 3%, and I don't know how many square miles that would be, but do you have any idea, or can you tell us at all how many towers, if you maximize that 3%, how many towers would we be able to, or would have to be erected to utilize that? Thank you.
Good question, Dennis. So your question has multiple components, if you wish. Let me answer the question quickly. Let's say, again, we're not planning floating farms right now in the future, so I don't know where we're going to go, but let's start first with the 3%. If you took 3% of the area of the Gulf of Maine, okay, that's the total area. That's including the 1 mile radius we talked about and so on and so forth. Just to be clear, the 3% includes that 1 mile we talked about, okay? So the 3% of the entire Gulf of Maine, the Gulf of Maine within 50 miles has about 156 gigawatts of capacity, okay, just of offshore wind capacity. 3% of 156 is roughly 5 gigawatts, okay, just to put that in perspective. So if you take 3% of the full area of the Gulf of Maine, you could generate roughly 5 gigawatts, and that 5 gigawatts is enough energy to fill every electric cars in the future in the Gulf of Maine and heat every home using electrical heat pumps. Okay, that's what we're talking about. So now, am I suggesting this is what we should do? No, I'm not. I'm just. It's a hypothetical number, just to say I'm putting if under it. If we harness 3% of the area of the Gulf of Maine, the energy in that area, if we did that, we're able to heat every home and drive every car, okay? that gives you a sense of what the potential is. It doesn't say, it doesn't, I'm not certainly advocating we do that. I'm just estimating what the potential is for us if we embarked on a journey like that. Okay. Now, does that help answer your question, Dennis?
Yeah. It certainly does. Thank you for that clarification.
You're welcome.
We'll do, we have one written question here and then I'll go to Sarah Flink, but this is similar. This is from Patrice McCarran. Regarding economy of scale to get affordable electricity, how many wind farms and or turbines are needed to achieve competitive affordable electricity?
I could say a wonderful question. it's a wonderful question. And I'm going to give you my opinion on it. So what's happened in Europe, if you observe what happened in Europe, they started with smaller farms. And the farms kept getting bigger and bigger and bigger. And as a farm kept getting bigger and bigger and bigger, and they developed the manufacturing infrastructure, they got better at it. And the price started to go down. And another part of it is the larger turbines have driven the cost down significantly. So when they first started, the turbines were 2 and 3 megawatts. Today, they're looking at putting 14 megawatt turbines out there. So think about if you had a 2 megawatt turbine versus a 14 megawatt turbines, you need 7 times more turbines with 2 megawatts than you have with 14 megawatts. So you have less to deploy, less to maintain, less mooring lines, less anchors. So the bigger turbines have driven the cost down significantly. So in terms of to answer your question, I believe a farm in the 800 megawatt range starts giving you the economies of scale to drive costs down. Okay, and if you look at what happened in Massachusetts. The farms that they've already approved, if you wish, in Massachusetts are in the 800 megawatt range. And for that reason, they've actually chosen 800 megawatts because it helps you reach an economies of scale and help drive some of the costs down. So is it a magic number? No. Okay. I don't think 800 is a magic number, but it's a number that starts to get you there, if you wish, for fixed bottom turbines. But I'd like to preface that with an asterisk, a very important asterisk. Fixed bottom turbine, what they're doing in Massachusetts are fixed bottom turbines. They've been around for a long time. And in Europe, we have a history of building a lot of fixed bottom turbines, and we've learned a lot from that. So in Massachusetts, by going to 800 megawatts, they've already building on experience of over 2 decades in Europe in learning how to make the machine work better, how to build the parts faster, develop the supply chain, and so on and so forth. In the floating world, we're not there yet. In the floating world, we're just starting new. So an 800 megawatt farm may not get us to the price that a fixed bottom farm is at right now. So I'd like to preface that for that reason with an asterisk. Okay, does that answer your question?
I think so. Sarah Flink?
Yeah, thanks so much, Dr. Dagger. This was really a fascinating presentation. I see that the local build and the workforce development is a big component of what you see this being of such a value for the state. And I'm curious, when you show that map of where the addressable market is for offshore wind, for floating wind, how far you imagine we could supply if these are being towed at sea? It's hard to imagine we would build them here in Maine and tow them around to California. But maybe we would. So I'm curious about that piece of, you know, if we're talking about building them here and the jobs that it could create here, how far it stretches for where we could supply them to elsewhere in the US or Canada or anything.
Very, very, very good question. So, Sarah, again, I'm going to talk about hypotheticals again, and I'm not certainly suggesting we do that. So if you look at the Gulf of Maine right now, it's all blue, right? Dark blue. Okay, so we have to go to floating, or we got no business, no offshore wind business. Currently, there are no facilities, port facilities I know of today, on the East Coast of the United States or on the West Coast of the United States are capable of putting out floating hulls. Okay, there are major investments in port facilities south of us that you've all been hearing about, major investments. To do fixed bottom turbines. So what we have an opportunity to do in Maine is really potentially invest in a port facility that allows us to do floating turbines, okay? And would be unique because nobody else has anything like that, okay? So that puts us in a position, and not everybody is gonna go out and do floating turbine. I don't think New Jersey or New York is gonna go to floating ports. They're already investing in fixed bottom ports. So our opportunity for Maine is really focusing on a port facility that would be specifically designed to facilitate the fabrication and deployment and operations of floating wind farms. Okay, and that animal doesn't look like a fixed bottom port facility. And I know there's a study ongoing right now that you'll be getting from Muffet and Nichols that will tell us a bit more about that particular subject. But that's what our opportunity is really doing that. So that's part one part of the question. So the first addressable market is our market in Maine, because that's the market we have more control over, if you wish, versus the other markets. So if you look at the addressable market in Maine, and again, if you look at the hypothetical, again, I'd like to preface that, and I'm not suggesting we build five gigawatts of offshore wind in the Gulf of Maine, but if we did, could we support a port facility and for our own use? So if we start building large farms, again, this is hypothetical, starting in 2030 and go to 2050, that's a 20-year build, right? And if we do 5 gigawatts, again, if, I'm not suggesting we do it, just to say if we do 5 gigawatts over a 20-year period, so you're looking at 4 gigawatts, you know, a quarter of a gigawatt a year, or if you want to do it all in 10 years, you might be able to do half a gigawatt a year, right? So if you did that, if you did half a gigawatt a year, how much investment is needed in 5 gigawatts of offshore wind? Roughly, it's $3 to $4 billion per gigawatt of investment, okay? So if you take $3 to $4 billion per gigawatt, let's call it 4 to make it easy to multiply, and you've got 5 gigawatts, 5 times 4 is about a $20 billion investment. Call it $15 to $20 billion. Of that investment, about $1 billion a gigawatt is the hulls alone. So let's look at the numbers. If we do 5 gigawatts between 2020 and 2030 and 2040, and if it's $1 billion just for the hulls, that's $5 billion worth of hull fabrication that a facility like that could potentially over a 10-year period support. So that's of course the maximum potential addressable market in Maine if we choose to go in that direction, it's not gonna be more than that. That's the maximum addressable market for us, 5 gigawatts, if we just look at heating and transportation in the state. Now, if we start looking south of us, where else could we go? And if you look at Massachusetts, for example, there are a lot of areas off the Massachusetts coast that are also deep water. The current areas that have been developed, the 800 megawatt farms that have been approved, are all in water depth of 150 or less. If you go beyond 150, where Massachusetts, say, maxes out their fixed bottom capabilities and decide to go beyond fixed bottom, they'd have to go to do floating hulls. Are they going to go out there and build a floating hull port facility? I doubt it. but if we had our own floating hull facility in the state of Maine, we're ready to do so, we could potentially tow these out. We've done towing studies, and if you put these hulls on a 100 by 400 foot barge, you can tow them in the 5 to 10 miles per hour. And so it's not unfeasible at all to be able to take them out to Mass from a facility in Maine, okay, in mid-coast Maine. So that's very feasible. So then all of a sudden the market grows significantly. If you start going farther south of that, you know, there are also opportunities other than Massachusetts that you see on that map. There are opportunities for New Hampshire, of course, as well, and to put energy on their grid and so forth. But is New Hampshire has a very short coastline? Again, nothing against our friends in New Hampshire. We love you all, but you have a very short, very very small coastline, and I think Maine and New Hampshire can work together, if you wish, to try to identify where farms might go, maybe in the southern Maine area, and they could be fed through a facility in mid-coast Maine. If for example, I know the governor is very interested in the area in Searsport. So can Searsport be such a facility that would not only deal with the main market potential, but also start helping with the New Hampshire and Massachusetts markets? Now, all of a sudden, we're getting a bigger market that we can address, if you wish, that can be addressed for Maine. I hope I've answered your questions there.
So. Absolutely. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Thank you. We have about five questions in Q&A. I think maybe I'll try to lock them together, give them to you all at once. And we want to be sensitive of your time, and we have other business to get to. So I'll just very quickly summarize these five questions, if it's all right with you. The first one deals with the anchor system. How far out do they extend from the windmill? How much area around the turbine will be off limits to commercial fishing, lobster, and dredge activity? That's one. Two, have you modeled vessel impacts on the hull integrity? And similar to that, have you looked at anticipated marine growth on the hull? And you know, how often do you anticipate the hulls to be cleaned? And then finally, a question on the Norwegian experience with Maine state government. How do you think that will affect investors going forward? Sorry for that mouthful.
John, thank you for asking all the questions in a firestorm. And now you're testing my memory. So I'm gonna go with the first one. The first one is, how far do the mooring anchors extend from the hull? If you're using steel chains, it's roughly 3 to 1. The scope of the mooring line is about 3 to 1. In essence, the distance from the hull to the anchor is 3 times the water depth, roughly. Okay, so if you're in 300 feet of water, then you'd be in you'd have roughly 900 feet distance from the mooring, from the hull to the mooring anchor. That's basically what you're looking at. That's when you use a steel chain technology. If you go to synthetic mooring line technologies, we hope our goal is to reduce that distance. Okay, by going to synthetic moorings. So a synthetic mooring would have roughly, if all goes well, 2 to 1 or less potentially scope. So in 100 feet, in 300 feet of water, the mooring anchor would be about 600 feet far from the hull if we use synthetic mooring lines. So basically we draw it down. Okay, so that's the answer on the mooring system question. There's another question related to
the hull design. Have you tested the integrity and then marine growth on the hull?
Yeah. So the marine growth question, yes, the hull is being designed for marine growth on it. Okay, we know marine growth will take place whether we like it or not, and so the beauty of marine growth is almost neutrally buoyant. The kind of marine growth we're looking at, we've done some studies where we looked at how fast marine grows in certain areas by based on these studies. We're designing the hull to already take to have a certain amount of marine growth, the marine growth that we expect in essence. So the answer for marine growth, yes, the hull's being designed for marine growth already. The next question is ship impacts. The American Bureau of Shipping actually has requirements to put bulkheads in the flotation columns to address ship impact. So, of course, we haven't run any ship onto our hull yet, and don't plan to, but depending on the size of the ship that's going to impact the hull, you can potentially have a puncture of the hull. And the question is, how do you deal with it? So the design we have has horizontal diaphragms inside the flotation columns, such that if there is an impact, the amount of water that the hull can take is limited to the distance between the diaphragms. Does that make sense? So therefore, if we get a ship impact, we design the hull to take essentially a certain angle, pitch angle. It will pitch so much when the distance between the two diaphragms filled up with water, and it's still serviceable. So you can go in there, fix it, pump the water out, and continue to use it. So that's the way it's designed right now. So it's designed to accommodate a ship impact that will fully puncture the hull. and it will still not sink it. So hopefully that answers that question.
Yes, and there are a couple other questions in the chat room, but we're going to need to move on. We have some Coast Guard business and some housekeeping matters. Thank you so much for your time, and we'll look forward to getting an update in this forum in the future. So thank you so much, Dr. Dagher. And I know there's a lot of work being done on this and a lot of opportunities for the public to comment. So again, thank you so much and look forward to having you back again.
Thank you, John. I appreciate the opportunity to be with you. Appreciate all the great questions that you've all had and look forward to working.